Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Tim Claddy. Tim is a partner and head of forensic advisory services for Grant Thornton Shanghai, where he manages a team of over 50 forensic accountants. He is also a professor at NYU and Webster University. He holds a PhD. He is a multilingualist. He has over 30 years operating in China alone, and his focus is on business ethics and investigations. And I'm very excited to share all of his expertise with us today, specifically around the topic of whistleblower interviews. And often when we think of a whistleblower, we think of somebody who alerts a company to an investigation, which is okay, it's true. But when we think about what it takes to encourage a whistleblower to both come forward, to tell the truth, and then to continue to tell the truth and own it moving forward, that is exactly the same cognitive process necessary that somebody needs to experience to open up in almost any situation. So it doesn't have to be your traditional, there's a crime happening and you don't know. It could be a problem with one of your customers, a problem with one of your projects. It could be anything. Understanding how and why whistleblowers think, act, and communicate the way they do is extremely important for all of us. And I'm thrilled that Tim decided to take the time and share his insights with us. So as we get into this conversation, beyond learning how to apply the lessons from whistleblower investigations throughout our business and personal lives, we're going to talk about how we can empower people to speak up. Tim is going to share his communication inhibitors and facilitators. He's also going to talk about how he builds rapport and trust cross-culturally, and he's even going to dive into how we can apply AI in the interview and investigations process. A lot of great stuff in this conversation. I'm super excited to share it with all of you. Thank you very much for being here for another episode. Please, while you're here, take a second, like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show. We appreciate it. Really quick, also before you leave, check out our show notes. That's where you can find our sponsors, HumanTel at HumanTel.com, for all of your scientific back training needs to understand when people's emotions are shifting by observing their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. CertifiedInterviewer.com is where you can learn all about not just what you can get, but what you can give to the International Association of Interviewers. It's also where all of your questions for the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation can be answered. And of course, you can go to Inquasive.com to learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them how to obtain the hidden confessions hiding in all of their everyday conversations. Appreciate you taking time to be here once again. So let's get right to it. Without further ado, I introduce to you Tim Claddy. Hello, Tim. It is great to see you today. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. It was great meeting you. I enjoyed our conversations. I'm really looking forward to diving into it more. And I appreciate you joining from quite literally the other side of the world today. So hopefully all is well in Shanghai.
Yes, it's been a busy day and I'm charged up and ready to share some insights. So it's been good today. Yeah.
Well, thank you for holding just a little bit in reserve for us at the end of the day. I really appreciate it. So in preparing for this conversation, I could probably have half a dozen different one-hour conversations with you and not repeat anything from your career track to investigations to working overseas to cultural differences and all of the things that you've been a part of. But when we met recently, you facilitated a presentation specifically about or in relation to whistleblowers and how they impact investigations. And for me, when I think about whistleblowers and how they impact investigations, my mind goes in a couple of different directions. So I thought I would open the conversation, if you will, just by asking you to give us your operational definition of what is a whistleblower and how they can positively impact the organizations that they work with.
Sure. And thanks again for the opportunity. I think the more we raise this issue and share these matters with the public, we get more of an awareness. One trend that I've seen working here in China over the last almost two decades now is that people are more empowered to speak up. So we're seeing more and more whistleblower opportunities in investigations among multinational subsidiaries in China, which is fantastic. People feel they have the right to be heard, and they're speaking up for it. So that's great. In terms of the definition of a whistleblower, I think we need to take a step back and look at the fact that whistleblowers could be anybody. They don't have to be internally in your organization. They could be external vendors or suppliers. They could be those shareholders in your company. They could be those managers in your company. Whistleblowers really are those who feel empowered, or they feel that they have more of a push inside to say something when they see something. The analogy I always use is that if you're seeing a light bulb that's burned out in the office, you're going to report it to maintenance or facilities, and they're going to get it fixed. Or if you see a live wire in the corner that needs to be repaired, someone's going to call and get that fixed. It's the same when you think about ethics and compliance. Everyone's got a duty and an obligation to see something and say something when they see something. And so that kind of whistleblower mentality should be put into a positive light. And whistleblowers can be anybody, anybody at all.
Couple of great lines right away to open up. That was awesome. I appreciate it. And one of the things that, and we talked a little bit before we hit record, that I love right away is a whistleblower is somebody who feels like they have the right to be heard and they've been
Yes.
empowered to speak up. And
Yes.
with our shared investigative, our investigative backgrounds are different, but they overlap a little bit. From that investigative mindset, a whistleblower is somebody who traditionally unlocks an investigation or kicks open an investigation and turns us on to fraud or something else that's going on that needs to be taken care of. But if we think about it from a straightaway business sense, a whistleblower can be somebody who alerts a CEO or a senior leader to an issue with a relationship or an issue with a process, or it could be anything that's not working right or the way it's supposed to be. There's a problem down the tracks that I feel like only I can see. And I believe I have the right. I've earned the right to speak up. I've been empowered to have this conversation. And all too often, I feel like I deal with people in investigations and in business who they're mad at somebody for not giving them information. And my first question to them is, well, at what point in time was it made okay for them to give you this information? And I thought your live wire analogy was perfect because all too often whistleblowers, in a sense, are looking at metaphorical live wires. Like this could cause a fire, this could blow up, this could be a real critical situation. So throughout your career, as you have worked with whistleblowers across continents, how have you learned or adapted your interview style or your communication style in order to help them feel empowered and be more comfortable sharing sensitive information?
Well, that's a question that probably needs the rest of the hour to answer, but
Let's
I'll
do
give
it.
you a quick overview. In general, you have to really put the whistleblower at ease in terms of understanding what their needs are. And before I jump into what that means, I'd like to say it's really important, just to piggyback off what you said, to separate the truth from the bias. A lot of times, whistleblowers will come into a meeting with an axe to grind or with an uneasy feeling that's more personal in nature and less about the facts at hand. So, one of the challenges that all of us have in this industry is that we have the responsibility to really sift out and determine in a very few short minutes, is this individual coming with a real passion and a decision to make a difference? Or are they coming to get even or get revenge or get their job back or get paid? What's the intention? So once you identify or start the process of identifying, get down that road, you really need to understand clearly what are they trying to achieve by coming and raising their hand and saying, I want to talk about an issue that I feel is unfair or unethical. So, throughout the whole interview process, you've got to put yourself in their shoes. You got to put yourself in their shoes to understand why they're doing what they're doing, number one, what they're trying to achieve, number two, and then from there, try to determine what is the best outcome for the organization. When you're interviewing as a third-party consultant, such as what I do, you have the interests of the organization at the top. But sometimes they're coming to throw and throw people under the bus and really put some personal bias into the conversation. And we have a shared responsibility as professionals to sift through that and make sure that it's more than just a session to complain. It's actually about focusing on the facts. So while I want to say, the right answer is to empathize and understand their concerns. We also have a kind of a sidetrack that runs in our minds as professionals to make sure they're speaking with facts and really fact-based knowledge rather than, throwing out personal vendettas.
I apologize. I had to cough, so I hit mute for a second. I wasn't ignoring you. That's a great point. And earlier in my career, we had a bit of a sort of standing policy where, in particular scenarios, if we had an employee giving us a tip on another employee, part of what you just described might lead to dual investigations. Could somebody, we ran into enough cases where it became quasi common where one employee, when they were committing fraud or stealing or doing something they weren't supposed to, would find out somebody else was, and they would snitch on that person to eliminate their competition. Like, this person might get me caught, or this person is making it harder for me to do what I want to do. So that's not to take away that there is a large, I'm assuming majority of whistleblowers have good intentions, but separating that bias, understanding the intentions, what are they trying to achieve, really maintaining that higher level of situational awareness is so important. I think when people, even whether they've conducted investigative interviews or not, when they think about interviewing a quote unquote guilty suspect, somebody who did something wrong, that's typically what they think of. And when they think about investigative interviewing, and when they think about interviewing a guilty suspect, they think about someone who's afraid to go to jail or afraid to get arrested or afraid to lose their job. And whatever they've seen on TV is how they think about, that's how you overcome those fears, whether it's accurate or not. Whistleblowers have fears as well. And my perspective, and I would love your correction or adaptation on this as necessary, is I would say many times the fears that whistleblowers have could include maybe getting arrested or losing their job, depending on the situation. But there's other more social related fears as well, maybe personal fears. How will I be believed or not? So on and so forth. And those fears, in the whistleblower's mind, can sometimes be more powerful in regards to stopping them from telling the truth than a potential guilty suspect's fears could be from stopping them from telling the truth. So I guess a double barrel question here. Number one, am I on the right track thinking that a whistleblower's fears, although they might not be what we would traditionally think is a fear in an investigative interview, can be equal or more powerful than a fear of just, you know, going to jail? And then, to the degree that we have to deal with those fears, what are some specific techniques that you have seen successful in helping people reduce those fears to share these sensitive facts?
Good. Yeah, that's definitely a double barrel question. let me start off by saying Hollywood paints a very unfavorable picture of this issue. If you go to Google and type in, Hollywood movies on whistleblowers or about whistleblowers, you'll get several hundred movies out there that really put a spin on it that's far from the reality. A lot of times, whistleblowers are concerned about retaliation. They're concerned about losing their jobs, like you've correctly pointed out. And they're also concerned about, being identified. And so this fear of alienation of inside the company, being labeled as the whistleblower, is definitely a reality for many people. And so a lot of times in my experience, we'll have one shot to talk to them. They'll go silent afterwards, or they'll kind of distance themselves because they fear if they give up too much information, then they're definitely going to be singled out. And, we can speak about culture in a couple minutes, but there's certainly an issue there that we need to be sensitive about when we're speaking to whistleblowers, because there's a concern of retaliation, there's a concern of trust, and there's a concern of alienation. So instead of putting light on all the concerns, I can speak a little bit about, how to fix or how to assure them. Certainly, it's critical when you're speaking to a whistleblower that you acknowledge those concerns. Don't just gloss over them like they're not important. You have to go back to that point I said earlier about showing empathy. I've always said that, EQ is important, but in the forensic business, IQ is important, but EQ is the most important. You definitely have to know when to take a step back and when to be stepping forward. because simply in interviews, some people will try to lead you down a path to achieve a point that may not be focused on the actual allegations. And so, again, separating the facts from the bias. Encourage them to communicate more. Encourage them to bring further information to the table. A lot of times they don't feel that information is important, so they'll just leave it out. But that's where the interviewing skills that we have as professionals comes into play to draw that out through different techniques and make sure that we've got all the facts at the table so we can make an informed decision or pass the facts to our clients for their informed decisions. Also give them channels to follow up and bring open communications after the interview. Sometimes information won't come to light until the next day. They may have said, "I forgot to tell him that," or "I forgot to ask that." And so always have an open line of communication after the interview takes place. Support, reassurance, document everything. These are key things that need to be considered. Show the whistleblower that what they're doing is making a difference. It's important, and it's going to bring the company's culture into a positive direction. So they have a kind of shared responsibility with you, and this is why they're doing it. So you've got to bring that constant reassurance back to them that this is important and it's for the right, for the greater good. So there are a lot of considerations, Michael, that have to be made when you talk to whistleblowers. But certainly, what they feel is important, please pick up on that and then ask those other questions to draw out other things that they may not feel as useful, but could be good for the investigation.
And so many great points there, Tim. Thank you. And one that I want to jump on real quick is
Yeah.
there are plenty of times when people leave out information and they're not lying to you. They
Right.
didn't think it was important. They didn't think the detail mattered. Maybe they were emotional and focused on something else. Honestly, there were times where I've reflected, watched videos of interviews I've conducted, and I thought I asked a great question in a moment, but then when I went back and watched the video, I realized I knocked them right off the track they were on because I wasn't patient enough. So it's my fault I didn't get that information because they might have just been about to share it. So realizing that, I would potentially argue in a very substantial percentage of time, people aren't leaving information out to mislead you. Either they didn't realize it was important, they didn't think about it, they were focused on another area. So that was a great call out. And leaving that open door for communication, it's the conversation isn't over today. We can keep it going. And something else there that I thought was extremely important was following up to the degree that we can, because sometimes whether somebody is a whistleblower in a full-blown fraud investigation, maybe it's a workplace violence or a sexual harassment investigation, or maybe to take it over to business, maybe it's a whistleblower into somebody's bullying leadership style, or somebody's being dishonest with a customer, or there's a disconnect between sales and production that's going to create a bigger problem down the road, or there's an issue with the vendor that I know about, nobody else does, whatever. But in all of those situations, people need to know, they need to feel that actions are being taken because of the risk that they've assumed to have the conversation. And, my wife is a chief human resources officer. So when somebody comes to her and says, "Well, so and so is sexually harassing women in the office," Brooke can't come back to them and say, "Well, these are the people I've talked to, and this is what they've told me." Like, there's confidential things. But if we give them evidence that we have taken action, evidence breeds trust. You didn't ignore me. You didn't just push this away. You did something. Maybe not what I wanted. Maybe I don't have all the details, but evidence breeds trust. So if we can give them back the evidence that we have done something with the risk that they've taken, we'll breed more trust. We should hopefully create more information or elicit more information.
And that's why it's really important to do your homework before the interview takes place. Go into the interview with knowledge of the individual, knowledge of the case, knowledge of the allegations. Is this the first time the whistleblower's spoken up? Is this the first time allegations have been made on this individual or those individuals or that department or that general manager? Understand their HR profile. Have they been passed over for a promotion recently? Is there a vendetta there they're trying to get even at the company? Were they not satisfied with their salary increase? What was that publicly made? Did they complain at the water cooler? Understand a little bit about the individual that you're going to speak to before you walk into the room. Not only does that make you look smarter, but it also allows the whistleblower to feel confident that their voice is being heard. and you actually care about the case. And this is not just another case file that you have to get through in 21 days. And so make sure that you're doing this because it's important not only for you, but most importantly for the other side, the person at the other side of the table, the whistleblower. And so I really want to encourage all listening, when you go into an interview with a whistleblower, please do your homework. Please make sure that you have the knowledge in front of you before you go and face them. They're going to probably test you to test your capabilities as well. And it goes before the interview. To me, one of the first things and the right things you can do is react to the individual's allegations. And my rule of thumb is within 72 hours. Get back to the whistleblower within 72 hours. Make sure that they have been responded to, or you're responding to them in a certain amount of time. This shows them that it's important. Request for a meeting face to face if you can. Request for additional information. And most importantly, assure their safety and protection. It's a big risk to raise your hand and say something if you're working in an organization that has given you a monthly salary and supports your cost of living and gives you insurance and helps you. You're kind of going against, you're going upstream, and that's not a favorable situation sometimes. And so it's risky and it's brave to do that. So you have to assure them that they're being protected.
Again, so many important little details. I'm sure you've had these conversations with people after interviews where they're like, well, how did you recognize this? Or how did you connect those dots? Or how did you know to ask that question? It was the homework you did before. Like, we go into every conversation being open to being surprised. There's always something we don't know that we have to learn. But by building that contextual awareness prior to going into the conversation, otherwise meaningless statements, question behaviors now have meaning in a greater context. So that homework is so important. That rapid reaction, that validation, helping people understand their safety in any conversation. Your child is trying to tell you that something is wrong in their social life. Rapid reaction, emotional safety, and validation is important. You have an employee coming to you. You have about a business related issue, an investigation related issue. All of these things are so important. I've heard you speak, so I understand that even just common sense, hopefully for most people, that rapport is always important. It's especially important in these conversations. How have you learned to build rapport with people who right out of the gate rightfully don't trust you? And when I say rightfully don't trust you, that's not a judgment of you. It's the situation. I'm taking this huge risk as a potential whistleblower. It's hard for me to trust the person that I'm opening up to. So, how have you learned to build rapport in the face of likely mistrust early in these relationships?
Yeah, that's a great question. And certainly it's hard to answer in such a short time frame, but I'll give you a quick response is that rapport is something that's earned. It's nothing that's taken for granted. And certainly when you trust them through the conversation and learn to talk with them through the conversation, you'll understand the motivations behind the individuals. And so while you're having the conversation, you've got to have another frame of mind that talks about or thinks about the motivations, why they're saying what they're saying. So there's a kind of psychology behind the whistleblower to flesh out during the discussion. Talk to them and understand, find that commonality. Say, appreciate what they're doing, commend them for their bravery, commend them for taking the first step to making the company a better place to work. Show them that it's making a difference. That's why the organization has brought forth this case and is going to see it through. One of the worst things a company can do is to ignore a whistleblower because it not only sends a signal to that individual that it's not important, but you're also sending a signal to every other employee in the organization or supplier or vendor or third party that this is not a priority for the organization. People like to talk about how important ethics is in the organization, but actions do speak louder than words. And so I really feel that before you go into the discussion with the whistleblower, have a kind of, I don't want to say a memorized script. You certainly don't want to do that. But certainly go into the discussion with a few objectives in mind that your mental checklist in terms of what would define a successful interview with a whistleblower. And then make sure that you hit those points. A couple of those would be you want to successfully build rapport with the individual to earn trust so that follow-up can actually take place. If you don't achieve point A, you're not going to reach point B. And so it's a kind of consistent approach that you have to take. A second objective that you want to achieve with the whistleblower is to get down the road where some of these allegations can be openly discussed. Sometimes there will be a point in the discussion where it brings a very uncomfortable memory for the individual and they don't want to talk about it. So you have to be sensitive to that. And so make sure in your mental checklist, you're sensitive, you're aware of those areas, not to those kind of hot button topics. And then certainly make sure that the individual is reassured that what they're doing is the right thing to do. This is not a tattletale exercise. This is not an objective to get your job back. This is more about actually doing what's right because you have a push inside and a reason to do this. You have a justification for this. So I think you've got to go into these interviews with mental checklists, but certainly don't be scripted.
I love all of that. Understanding the outcomes, and thank you for sharing a few very important outcomes. And I love how on your list, one of the outcomes wasn't like get the claim in details, or
No,
you know,
no,
it's
no.
that will take care of itself if
That's
we
right.
focus on the actual strategic outcomes that we need to achieve with another human being. If we ever go into an interview and on our and it doesn't have to be a formal investigative interview. We're sitting down to have a conversation with a customer, with a client, with a vendor, with an employee on our team who feels like there's an issue, with your child, spouse, it doesn't matter. If we go into that conversation and the outcome we're looking to achieve is get all the details, that's not an outcome. Like that's almost a
That's
side
right.
effect based on achieving the more important outcomes of executing a strategy and creating psychological safety and bonds and relationships and all of these other things that we have to do. And I love even going further back in the conversation where you talked about what's right for the organization. So when we
That's right.
talk about this in a business sense, there are the organizational goals that we need to make sure that we protect. There might be, you mentioned before, vendor relationships within or outside the organizations. Certainly, I can't speak to this in China or really too far abroad from the United States, but there are employee relations concerns and there's legal concerns and all these other things that we have to factor into the outcomes that we set out to achieve. When I've heard you speak before, you talked a lot about both inhibitors and facilitators of great communication or successful communication. I don't, if I have the words wrong, excuse me. So I like to separate those for a moment. I guess we'll start with the inhibitors first, if you don't mind. So then we can kind of end on a happy note or end this segment on a happy note. We'll go from the inhibitors to the facilitators. But in your experience, what have you seen to be, maybe they're well-intentioned, but what have you seen to be some of the biggest inhibitors to great communication and encouraging people to share sensitive information?
Sure. Great question. I've got four or five listed here, and I think these are kind of best practices. Certainly, it depends on the situation. Two of the greatest words that we can memorize in interviews is it depends. It really depends on the situation at that time. And you have to really be flexible and agile to follow and go with the flow of the individual that you're interviewing. Please don't go into interviews with a robotic mentality. Go in there with the ability to ebb and flow as the conversation progresses. And so be aware of these inhibitors. Inhibitors would be those who would, those situations where the interview is slowed down, stopped, misguided, misdirected, or just off track. One of them would be to threaten their ego. They're coming to you with a level of trust, and they're coming to you with an objective to share information that matters to them. And then you start doubting their ego, and you start doubting, you know, making them feel embarrassed for doing this, making them feel guilty for what they're doing. Don't do that. That will only stop the conversation and get them off track as quick as you don't want it to happen. So that's definitely one inhibitor. Another is just what I call the etiquette barrier. When you're talking to them, be respectful. Make sure that you've got an appropriate setting in the interview. Make sure that it's conducive for a conversation that builds trust and rapport. Make sure that they have, certainly with all interviews, make sure that they have comfort that they can stop the interview at any time. This is not a forced discussion. This is an open talk and an open interview. So make sure you're aware and you're conscious about the etiquette around, and don't put any barriers or blockages in that. Another one is, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, sometimes you'll trip on a topic that will be sensitive to them. It'll be traumatic for them. But you don't know it. You're just saying something that reminded them of a very tough situation that they had to experience or go through. So be aware of that. Words matter, and the words you choose in an interview matters the most. And so make sure that you're not pushing an issue that when you see their body reaction, their body language show some type of traumatic matter, put the brakes on and change topic and go forward to a different direction. So that's another inhibitor for sure. Another one is what I call the greater need. When you're talking about or asking questions about interest, but they keep talking about their position. So, bring them back on track, but do it in a way that your EQ skills are exemplified. Make sure that you're talking to them in a way that they're focused, but also don't push them off the rails too far. If they want to talk about themselves, let them do it for a couple of minutes. Let them open up and talk about themselves, because when you're listening, you're also building trust and rapport as well, rather than interrupting and cutting them off. And then another one is a final one is irrelevancy. What as you said as well, Michael, is some things that you may not feel are important, but he or she will mention it, or vice versa. They don't mention it, but you feel you got to get that allegation proved one way or another. Just kind of go with the flow and make sure that you don't push issues too much, because that'll make them feel very uncomfortable, which could certainly inhibit the flow of the discussion overall. So those are the five inhibitors that I think are considerations for whistleblower interviews. Let me speak for a couple of minutes about facilitators, if I can. Certainly, making sure that they have these altruistic appeals. What they're doing is for the greater good. You're working towards a common goal. You're working to achieve something that's in the best interest of the organization. Making sure that it's more about the greater group than it is about the self-interest that they may say. So, use that in a way to encourage trust and build rapport by saying, I'm really grateful that you came and agreed to speak with me today. And you may not feel it today, but you're actually making a big difference, not only for our company, but for the entire industry. This is something that's going to actually be groundbreaking, because you're going to shed something to light that, no one's ever done before. And you're really in an important position to make this change happen. So really play into the altruistic approach. Another way is show some empathetic understanding. Exactly what I said for the last 30 or 40 minutes. Make sure that you show empathy and you really put yourselves in the shoes of the whistleblower. Understand that it's a brave task to do what they're doing, and reassure them that their protection is paramount. Reassure them that what they're saying is important. And also, equally important, reassure them that what you're going to do is going to follow up immediately, and it matters what they're saying. They're going to make a difference. I'd also like to talk about recognition. Recognition is an inhibitor, a facilitator for sure, because when you recognize what they're doing, you're talking about how they're making a difference, and you're giving them confidence and boosting them up a little bit to, talk more. You want to have whistleblowers, and we can speak in a couple of minutes about the different types of interviews, because whistleblower interviews are not really admission-seeking interviews. And they're not really information gathering interviews. They're kind of a hybrid between. And so when you look at different facilitators, recognizing what they're doing is helpful, recognizing that they're making a difference, but knowing that you don't want to push them into something if it's not actual. Don't force them into an allegation if it's not what they said. So I think I've spoken a lot, but those are some facilitators and also some inhibitors. I hope that helps.
It helps big time. And on the inhibitor side, so many important details. Again, not forcing someone to defend their ego. Like, not embarrassed. Rule number one, don't cause someone to feel embarrassed at any time ever. Like,
That's
don't
right.
cause them to feel embarrassed. Don't cause them to feel judged. So super important. I love how you called it the etiquette barrier, and with some culture related questions for you coming up there. When you talked about the reading their body language, if you trip on a traumatic topic, please, for people who are listening to the conversation, be an evolved observer. Just because somebody fidgets or blinks or breaks eye contact or touches their nose or does all these things that you've been told over your lifetime mean that people are lying, it doesn't mean that they're lying necessarily. It could mean that there's a now a peak level of discomfort related to a new topic in a conversation. And that could be because of re-experiencing trauma. It could be even unexpected detail. It could be even any a million things unrelated to deception. So please recognize that. That was such an important call out. And then on the facilitators, that follow up, that recognition, so important, focusing on the altruistic values. And I love the connection that you made that, yes, in certain scenarios, we might be able to separate a fact gathering interview from an admission seeking interview, depending on the context of it. Although I think we could all talk about times where one turned into the other, perhaps unexpectedly, depending on what we were learning along the way. But when we're encouraging people to share sensitive information in vulnerable circumstances under the perceived or real threat of potential consequences, there are so many alignments in how we have those conversations. So I guess it's choose your own adventure time for follow-up questions based on everything that you said. But let's go there first before we dive into the culture questions. When
Sure.
you are having a conversation with somebody, and I guess we'll just focus on these whistleblower interviews for a moment. How do you see the integration of techniques for other potential formalized interviews in order to really connect with somebody and get them to share this in many ways secret or perceived secret that they haven't told anybody else?
So let me reinstate. Your question is really about how do you get build the trust, or what specifically do you want me to focus on?
Well, thank you for following up and pointing out an unclear question. I appreciate that. You mentioned earlier that in the many whistleblower interviews, it can be really a combination or an integration of multiple techniques. It's not quite fact finding,
For
not
sure.
quite necessarily seeking an admission. However, depending on how the conversation shifts, those elements could intertwine. So I'm curious in how you do that.
Yeah, so let me take a step back, and if I can, first of all, share a little bit about the kind of fraud that we've seen here. The reason I want to start with that answer is because that kind of directs and guides the conversation. If I can, I'm working in an environment that is certainly, well, it's relationship based. So Chinese culture is very relationship driven, and so it's about the connectivity of your former college classmates, or your someone from the same city where you grew up, or someone that used to work in the same company. So those issues, what we call conflicts of interest. This is a very big issue that we're seeing that causes whistleblowers to kind of raise their hand and say, something's not right here. It doesn't look good and it smells funny, so it's going to have to be an issue. They're giving potential favors or relationship advantages to a supplier because it's their cousin, for example. So one of the biggest issues that we've seen here doing investigations for multinationals or US companies in China has been conflicts of interest. Kickbacks is another reason for a whistleblower to raise their hand and say, this isn't right. Giving favorable treatment or giving what we would call here commission, which is the same word as kickback in Chinese. That's really a gray matter when you've got the same word meaning two different things. When you're overstating expenses or mischaracterizing expenses, and so you're misallocating your accounting. So that's something that we also see. And then also the other issue is certainly talking about how you can deal with whistleblowers when they're dealing with technical matters. So you have to take a step back and say, all right, break it down for me. Teach the teacher. Be humble. Don't go in there with an arrogant attitude in an interview and say, I know it all. Just tell me the facts and let's get this over with. Make sure that you allow them to build their confidence by telling you the story and teaching what they saw. A lot of times, whistleblowers are concerned that only they know the information. So if it's revealed, then we know who it is. And so you got to make sure that you're letting them tell you at the detail or the level that you want. So those are the kind of frauds that we've seen. And then I also would like to kind of follow up with that to kind of differentiate the types of interviews that we have here. As we've both pointed out, is that this is not admission seeking. We're not seeking a confession from them to, be involved or to point out specific people. And we're certainly not just here to get information just because it's nice to know. We have to make sure that we're pushing a little bit. So it's a kind of balance. You want to show empathy, you want to show humanity and trust, and you want to talk about cooperation and rapport and those keywords. But also in these whistleblower interviews, you kind of want to, bring a little pressure to make sure that they're not, just pulling your leg or they're pushing you in a wrong direction. Follow up with questions. Make sure that the facts that they say are indeed can be proven or verified. Ask open-ended questions. Let them tell you the story, and then, if they move in a different direction, catch them in that. So another key point to take away is you have to be an active listener when you're in a whistleblower interview. You're not checking boxes and filling up 2 pages of paper just to submit notes to your supervisor. You're actually actively listening to the discussion, and you're moving and moving, your questions around what they've said instead of what you've prepared in advance.
All great. So many points there. But before I forget to ask, you mentioned that in Chinese, the word for kickback and commission can be the same, and
It
that
is the
creates a
same.
gray area. So,
Crazy.
yeah, I'm curious as to how you deal with that. Do you run into scenarios where people try to use that to explain it away and make it okay? Obviously, I don't speak Mandarin or Chinese or any one of the languages that are spoken over there. So do you have to like contextually frame your questions or situations different in order to clarify? How do you handle that?
I can share just a quick case study. We did a case a couple of years ago where the CFO called us and said, "We've got an issue because a whistleblower submitted an Excel spreadsheet from your finance department or your sales department, sorry, and of the sales department, and they left a column on there that said commissions, but it's in Chinese, so I don't know if it means commissions or kickbacks because it's the same word, Weikou." And so we went in there, and he didn't delete that column K that had 10%, 15%, 25% to all these vendors and suppliers. And that triggered an investigation. And sure enough, these were not commissions or pre-approved signed contractual agreements that will give an introduction fee or something like that. These were, "You bring me business and I will favorably treat you with financial gain. I will give you cash money." And so basically that column was forgotten. He forgot to delete it, and that resulted in an investigation. So sometimes, when actually all the time, when you have a situation, take a step back, identify the intention of the action. So what's the intent? What's the reason that that kickback or commission was given? Was it to say thanks? And was it instead of cash, was it a company gift with a logo on it in public, presented in public? Or was it a red envelope, as we see in Chinese culture, contextual context, or cash in an envelope that is given in private on a golf course or someplace where no one else will see? And so let's take a step back and go to the intent of the action. And I think that's going to help, deliver a result or an answer that will help the investigator, whether it's in-house or external, determine if this is unethical or not. And so intent, that's really critical.
Yes, it's in many cases paramount, I would imagine, especially when it's not a clear cut, like this is absolutely fraud. Like when there's any type of gray area, any type of explainability, contextual nuance, that intent becomes super important. When you were talking about the interview earlier, just hearing you say, even let them tell the story. Don't interrupt, don't interject, don't force it off the tracks. If they go in a different direction, come back after, but let the truth come to you. Have that patience. Let them tell you the story. We've teased around it a few times, but one of the things that I was really drawn to when you and I first spoke was the diversity of your experience from working here in the United States for organizations to as a representative for the United Nations to then being overseas for as long as you have. How have you had to adapt your approaches for all of the different cultures that you have interacted with?
Yeah, I've worked in 4 countries, 6 cities. So I've been around in terms of doing forensic work and forensic investigation, and all the work that I've done, cultural innuendos play a paramount role in determining intent, what their objectivity is, and trying to identify really why these allegations are on paper and being focused on bringing someone down. In the China context, as I said, relationships are very important. Face is very important, making sure that you're not singling people out. And when that's done, they've lost face. Now they have to defend themselves. And certainly across borders, you're seeing this a lot as well. We operate here in Shanghai, serving US companies. And a lot of times we want to talk to the whistleblowers, not only in their local language, but also in the local dialect. Making sure that they're free to express themselves as naturally as possible so they have a comfort level to build trust and rapport. And so if we know that someone is wanting to speak to us down from Guangzhou or Shenzhen, we'll bring in a Cantonese speaker from my team to talk to them in the local in the local dialect. If the whistleblowers here in Shanghai, we'll bring in a local colleague here to speak Shanghai dialect with them. And certainly if they're knowing your whistleblower, doing your homework, if you can talk to them in their local dialect, I think that's going to go a lot farther. There are some, things to consider, like gender, for example. Typically, in the local context here, it's probably going to inhibit trust and rapport if you have a female speaking with a female and vice and male versus and speaking with a male as well. I think that gender balance is something that will bring a little bit level of comfort to them. Also, please consider the location where they're from. I'm just talking in the China context, but I'm sure some of your listeners have subsidiaries in China or have business in China. And so that you got to think of China as multiple countries in a single border, just like the United States sometimes is looked at as 50 countries in a single border. They all have their own cultures and contexts in the north and the south and the central part. And so it's really important to recognize that and understand that that will drive motivations for some people. And I think that's something that we need to consider in terms of the cultural impact and the collectivism and things like that. So you have to apply different interviewing techniques when you're speaking to individuals from different parts of the country.
Amazing point, and I'm going to use the word impressed for lack of a better word with so many of the differentiations as you look across the world. So it's not, I mean, China's an enormous country, but it's not just the Chinese. Like where you're from specifically can play such a big role. And like you said, it's true here in the United States. I grew up in New England. My wife is from Alabama. We have a wonderful relationship. Sometimes we might feel like we're from a different country, depending on what we're talking about or what our experiences are. I just want to circle back to one thing. So when you talked about gender, did I understand correctly that it could be an inhibitor to have a man interviewing a man? Like it might actually be better to have a female interview a man, or is it the opposite?
It's the opposite.
Okay.
You're going to want sometimes, well, all the time, whistleblowers are coming to you because they feel that they have to say something that is sensitive, confidential, and certainly you don't want to put a barrier between them, such as I said, body language is really important. Building rapport can go a little bit faster if you can bring some similarities between you and the whistleblower. For example, in my case, I've studied in China. I studied in China 30 years ago in 94. And the place where I studied, if I have a chance to speak to somebody from that part of the country, I'll bring back my history of when I was a college student in their city. And they'll feel a little bit that level of comfort or something. Or I'll speak a little Shanghai dialect to them, or a little, I'll do the interview in Mandarin for them. And that'll make them feel a little bit closer to build trust. Gender, it's the same. I think whistleblowers, if we know they're female, they'll probably would feel more comfortable if a female investigator was interviewing them. And same for males too.
Makes sense. When you bring in the different interpreters, especially that speak different dialects, I mean, you just mentioned being able to speak Mandarin, so I don't know how much overlap there would be or how much you might be able to just generally pick up based on any similarities between the languages. I'm completely foreign and don't want to even pretend that I would know.
No problem. No
But
problem.
how have you learned to work through interpreters in order to make sure that you're not just getting the facts, the statements, but you are understanding correctly the context and the intent and you're getting the total truth?
Actually, Michael, we don't really use interpreters. I'm doing the interviews in Mandarin. And my staff are all fully bilingual, trilingual. That we're doing the interviews directly with the whistleblowers because we're trained investigators. And so, like you said, there could be issues or situations where an interpreter could lose things in translation. And that's the one thing that we want to avoid. We don't want to put an extra person in the room to muddy the water. And so we try to put our investigators in a position where they're comfortable to lead the investigation and apply their linguistic skills for that. So in our context here, we don't really use interpreters.
That's fantastic. So when you were mentioning the different dialects, you've got people on your team that speak those dialects and they come in directly to do it.
That's right. That's right. And I think it's something that plays to our advantage because, as I said, typically with a whistleblower, you've got one shot to interview them. It's very rare that they're going to come back and say, "Okay, let's speak for another 4 hours." They're concerned about their safety, about their protection, and so right out of the gate, you've got to reassure them of that. But you've got to realize that this could be your one opportunity to get the information. So please, as I speak to your listeners, make sure that you're prepared. Preparation is definitely the key to any level of success for a whistleblower interview, and make sure that you have the right information on paper in front of you or in your mind to ask, so you're not unprepared. I think that's critical.
Yeah, it's absolutely critical. And it ties back into something you said earlier, almost in passing, about the importance of meeting people where they are. Things like where you have the conversation are extremely important. Is it a place where they're comfortable, where they're more relaxed, where they're going to be op more open to open up? And an offshoot of that is having somebody who can speak their dialect. And the more respected that they feel, the more comfortable that they feel through these little gestures, the greater the likelihood of success, not just in the interview, but really in the relationship. And on that end, you threw out a word earlier, and I don't know how many people caught it, but collectivism. And for the base understanding that I have is often many of us here in the United States, we're more of an individualist culture, and where you are in China is more of a collectivist culture.
That's right.
How have you learned to build relationships in a collectivist culture that might be different or counterintuitive from how we would build relationships here in the United States?
Yeah, that's great. That's a great point. I'm glad you raised that. Again, it goes back to telling them that they're part of the team. They're making a difference, not only in some cases for their department, but for the organization, as I said earlier, for the industry. Bring them into the fold to say that we all have a shared responsibility to do the right thing, and I commend you for taking the first step to make that happen. I recognize the concerns. I recognize the risks that you're taking for doing this and raising your hand, because it's not easy, and not everyone has the bravery to do what you're doing. So bring them into the fold and make sure that they feel they are included in the situation. Never doubt, openly doubt, unless you really feel the intent is not there, is wrong. Never really call to question what they're telling you. Of course, be watchful and mindful as an interrogator and as an interviewer, but certainly be respectful. And go back to the empathetic side. Put yourself in their shoes. Make sure that you recognize what they're doing is not something that everybody can do. And so I think that's really important when you speak of collectivism. Don't isolate them, make them feel they're on an island. Put them in the situation together with you, making a difference and really making a change. I think that's really important that everyone's in this together. And we've interviewed, six whistleblowers on a single case. And one good thing, best practice, is to corroborate the information. Make sure that they're, telling their story, and help that helps us as investigators identify, who can we trust and who we cannot trust, and who should we try to follow up with, and who should we just let go after the first interview. And so there'll be cases or situations where we will have multiple whistleblowers on a single case. And that'll help our story, because it'll help with corroboration. That's very important.
That's another tremendous point. If you're gathering intelligence from multiple sources, it gives you the opportunity to cross-reference the intelligence
That's
that
right.
all of those sources are sharing. You can triangulate it. You can give more credibility in places. You can create additional questions. That's a tremendous point. And it gives you the opportunity to, you mentioned earlier that sometimes people, especially in whistleblower-related cases, and again, this could be your traditional criminal, it could be an investigation, it could be there's a problem with a relationship or a process in the business somewhere. But if somebody feels like I'm the only person in the world that could have this information, so if it comes out, there's going to be a giant spotlight on me. That's an enormous hurdle. So now if we have multiple sources, it makes it easier for us to play I don't know if this is the right way to say it, but almost like the intelligent shell game. Like we can disguise where the information came from. And for me, I felt like one of the skills that I don't know that was necessarily taught, but thankfully the team I worked with helped me learn, was the ability to, and again, maybe not the best choice of words, disguise or create the perception that this information could have came from multiple places. So one of the ways that we help people feel safe and protect themselves can be to illustrate other modes or other opportunities or other ways that this information could have come to the surface in order to help them save face and feel more comfortable sharing it.
That's right. That's right. I would like to share a couple of points if I can about AI.
Please.
I think there's tools out there, and certainly if your listeners haven't really dug into this, I think it'd be good to kind of just inform. I don't really want to go into the greater details of it, but I just want to share that my view and my application of AI and forensic investigations is becoming more and more common. There are software tools out there that can identify and can help the investigator in terms of emotional distress or perhaps perceived lying or deception. And so there are tools out there that can kind of look at the body language of the individual and the fidgetiness or the action or even the speech patterns of the individual. And you record the interview and you play it back and you analyze it with an AI tool to identify speech patterns. That is a really nice thing to put to your advantage when you're trying to, separate the wheat from the chaff, as we say. And so there are tools out there, software tools, that not only can look at the body language, but can identify speech patterns, can look if their palms are sweating or if they're moving their legs all the time or bouncing their legs. These are not tall tale confirmations, as you said earlier. These are not going to put you in a position to say with confidence that individual is a liar. However, these tools will help facilitate the decision-making process and identify or at least impact the trajectory of your conclusion. And so I think these types of AI tools are out there. In my presentation, when we first met, I listed like 9 or 10 different tools that are out there. And it's certainly something that could be of interest to your listeners because as we move into a world where technology is playing a more greater role in investigations, I think we have to, use these as support facilitators. And so I think that's a topic that I wanted to raise before we concluded.
I'm glad you did. Thank you. And I love how you worked it in, and also how you mentioned like it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody is lying. It's
No,
showing
right.
changes in their established behavior pattern, maybe changes in their comfort levels, their stress levels. And even if we have the ability to go back and rewind interviews, watch them again. If we're going to have an iterative relationship with somebody throughout the course of an investigation, we're going to talk to them again. If I can do a better job at understanding what they look and sound like when their comfort level changes, then I can do a better job adapting as necessary during my conversations to help them manage their comfort levels, so they're more likely to give me the sensitive information that I require to create these outcomes for the organization. Tim, you have shared a ton of great ideas and information and approaches today. Thank you so much. There is no doubt that people are listening right now, whether they have colleagues in China, whether they have business interests in China, or whether they just want to continue to develop their skill set. If you could, please let us know for people who might be looking to reach out to you, connect with you, maybe partner with you, or learn more from you. Where and how can they reach you and connect with you?
You can send me an email, tim.claudi@cn.gt.com. Feel free to share my CV, which has got some background information, and also you can include the email address there. I make frequent trips to the US, and I'm happy to, follow up. We can start with an email discussion and then take it from there. If I can give a couple minutes conclusion, Michael,
Please.
I would like to say that we all have a responsibility to do the right thing when we interview whistleblowers. And I think this is something that it's only going to increase. If you look at the numbers from the SEC or the DOJ, which now has a whistleblower program as of August of this year, and then, of course, the overseas whistleblower programs, the numbers are increasing. I think last year alone, there was over 18,000 calls into the SEC whistleblower hotline. 18,000 reports. And this is not just a US focus. I mean, SEC is a global program. And so it's not a matter of if, but it's a matter of when. And so we need to be prepared for these whistleblowers investigations, and we need to do our homework and understand that they will occur. So preparation is key. Having the skills of an EQ investigator is key, and then also making sure that you ask the right questions. So I think those are some of the key points. And as you said, I'd be happy to follow up with anybody if you've got questions.
Well, I'll absolutely share your email, your CV, your links. Thank you so much. I know it's later in the evening for you. You're wrapping up a long day and you took the extra time to be here for us. I'm truly grateful for it. Thank you for all you shared. It's been a pleasure getting to know you, and I really look forward to keeping our conversations going.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks to all the listeners for your support. Appreciate it.
Tim, thank you so much for a great conversation. I appreciate you carving out to join us at the end of your day in Shanghai for the conversation. Thank you very much. All your preparation, all of the details and examples that you shared, thank you. I really appreciated how you talked about the importance of putting people at ease. All too often, we rush into conversations or we impose authority on people, whether we realize it or not. And that can be counterproductive. If we really want people to open up and be honest, we have to put them at ease. I also really appreciated how you talked about determining intent and some of the cultural intricacies that can go along with that as well. But when we're investigating anything, when we're drawing information from people, it's very important that we factor intent into our decision-making process. Of course, the importance of being agile and how critical it is to do our homework. We can make a lot of things look easy. We can be open to a lot of alternatives, and we can build much better credibility when we've done our homework in advance. Thank you, Tim. I appreciate everything you shared. And of course, thank you to everybody that took the time to join us today. I hope you took a bunch of notes and got as much from that conversation as I did. Before we go, let's thank our sponsors again real quick. Check them out in the show notes. We have Humantel. Please head over to humantel.com. Enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the scientific best-in-class training to understand when people's emotions are shifting based on changes in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com, where you can learn all you need to know, not only with what you can get by joining the International Association of Interviewers, but what you can contribute as well. That's also where you get all of your questions and updates on the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. And finally, while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. And that's where you can learn more about the program our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them how to apply the persuasive observation and communication skills necessary in order to encourage people to share their everyday confessions that unlock the truth in our high-value conversations. Thank you all for continuing to show up week after week. Thank you for liking the show, sharing the show, subscribing to the show. We truly appreciate it. Stay safe. Take care of each other. We'll see you next time. Thank you.